show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. On this week's program, we welcome two writers, a mother and her son, both who are no strangers to bestseller lists. Anne Rice is one of America's most read and celebrated authors. Her books are rich tapestries of history, belief, philosophy, religion, and compelling characters. She's the author of over 30 books, including The Vampire Chronicles. Her latest is The Wolves of Midwinter. Christopher Rice is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers. He's the son of Anne Rice and the late poet Stan Rice. His latest is The Heavens Rise. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, and recorded before a live audience. You look great.
You're talking to me?
Yes. Oh, my God. You look great. Chris, so do you.
I try.
Yeah.
I try.
Do you enjoy sharing this artistic time together?
Oh, yeah. I was saying, I think this is the longest period of time we've spent together in a while. And we see each other very often. You live 2 hours away from me, but I'll go out for the holidays. But we're on the road together for 3 weeks, and we have not had one temper tantrum yet. But I did accidentally bump into her last night in New York as we were doing the paparazzi walk, and I knocked her out of her shoe in front of the cameras. And of course, the cameraman didn't help. They went like much like this right now, only she was, you know, injured. So if that doesn't start a fight, I don't know what will. Knock on wood.
It was okay.
Do you like this? There was a time when it was, I mean, completely nuts when you would go on tour.
Yeah.
And you were going in the buses, and there were, you know, thousands of people, and they were all dressed up, and it was all, I mean, isn't this a little nicer? You get 500 people, you go a little bit, it's a little bit quiet.
This is nicer. When you have an 8-hour signing, you really can't talk to people individually. I mean, that was exhilarating and fun to sign for 8 hours. It was like a test of endurance, but you really didn't get to relate to anybody very long. I mean, we still don't, you know, if a signing goes 2 or 3 hours, but we have a little more time now, and it's a little more relaxed, and frankly, I do enjoy it better now.
You've had so many phases of your career and different types of books. Before we delve into that a little bit, talk about what brought you to this Chronicles, and The Wolf in particular.
Well, I really wanted to get back with supernatural themes, and I wanted to get back with kind of venerable supernatural themes. I mean, I loved working with the vampire, the witch, the ghost, the mummy, all of those things that I had enjoyed so much in old black and white movies. And I hadn't done wolves. And a friend of mine suggested it. It was Jeff Easton. He's a television producer. He does the show White Collar and Graceland. Those are his two shows. And I only know Jeff by email. I've never met him. But he happened to send me an email and said, if you ever tackle werewolves, I really would be interested. You know, I would buy that book. For some reason, I thought, well, why don't I do that? I was not at a place that I was happy with what I was trying to do at that point. So I thought, let me do something completely new. Let me have a new character, a new cosmology, new everything. And I went for it, and I enjoyed it. I got the intensity that I'm always looking for. If I hadn't gotten the intensity, I would have moved on to another topic.
When do you know you have the intensity?
There are early signs, but it can stick. You know, you could get off to a glorious start, and then maybe after 30 pages it would die. But it kept rolling with this. And first I did like a 40-page treatment of what I wanted to do, which I've never done before, really. And then I thought, I really want to do this book. I want to make this, you know, into a real book, not just a TV treatment, but, you know. And I started to write about this character, Reuben, and he came to life, and it started to roll. I work a lot through instinct. I trust spontaneous developments on the page, and I trust a feeling of authenticity, and all of that clicked for me, and pretty soon The Wolf Gift was done. And right away I went into The Wolves of Midwinter, the next book.
You have the first book, and it's The Wolf Gift, a novel, and now it's The Wolf Gift Chronicles.
Yes,
so
yeah,
I mean, you're in it now.
I am in it, yes, I'm in it, and I've got a third book imagined, and I want to get to that.
And that's a nice place to be, I would think.
It feels very good. It feels very good. It feels very good to be working with something brand new to me, you know, rather than going back 30 years to ideas I developed when I was sort of a different person.
Do you feel, being a different person, that you're a different writer?
Oh, I don't know. I think all of us change over time, and I think my career in particular has been marked by departures and detours, and I don't know how to describe it. You know, I've never really written neat books or episodic books in any series that follow one on another so much as a lot of highly individual books that somehow become series. And that can be very frustrating to readers. You know, some readers like that very much. They like being surprised, and some don't.
It seems, though, and looking out at the wonderful crowd we have here tonight, I mean, you've maintained through these departures and changes, you've maintained that fan base.
Well, a lot of readers do follow me wherever I go. But there's no consensus among my readers in general as to what's my best series or best book or best character. You know, I have readers that don't speak to each other. You know, I mean, it's clearly, you know.
So. And not to be flip, but do you care?
Well, yeah, I do. I do because, you know, I have a Facebook page with about 850,000 people on the page. And people will come on the page and they'll say some pretty heavy things. And sometimes I'm a little too thin-skinned about that, and I try to plead for a particular book or a series and say it's really got the same elements that were in the other one that you're talking about. And I get too involved in that, I guess. I wish we were all happy together all the time.
You know? Me too. I don't know how you read that. To me, it's like going to your own funeral. It's just,
I'll tell you though, 99% of the experience is positive. I love it. I go on every morning and talk to the people of the page, and I get such wonderful feedback from them. I can ask them any question I want. You know, like if you liked the Vampire Chronicles, what did you like least about them? And I'll get 2,000 answers in a couple of hours. And
well, why are you asking them that? Don't ask them that.
No wonder
there's almost a funeral on your Facebook page. Where am I not living up to your expectations today?
I want to know what they think and feel, and I learn from all of it.
I would think, though, for you starting out almost at just before social media really took off, but I assume that became a big part of the start of your career, didn't it?
Well, what was really taking off when I started, which was in 2000, was the rise of internet reviews. And so at 2 in the morning, when you were looking for validation, you could go online and find out what a total stranger had to think of your work and why they thought you should never write again. And it was great for your self-esteem. And let me tell you, the only problem I have with any of it is the anonymity factor. I think if you're going to post an opinion, you should be allowed to post whatever opinion you want online, but I think you should be expected to put your actual name to it, which ironically Facebook sort of requires you to do, although I will notice a lot of angry people on Facebook are apparently cartoons because their profile photos are like a snake wrapped around
angry.
A witch and Winnie the Pooh, and they're telling you to go to hell.
Yeah.
You know, but it was part of it. You know, it was this attitude that we're all in this big communal digital space now, and everyone has an opinion about everything all the time, you know. But there are great things that happen out of that. There are writers that get discovered who might never have been discovered previously. You know, there are voices that rise to the top. Frank Rich said recently in New York Magazine that for every hoax that goes online, it's disproved by the internet almost as quickly, that the power of the internet comes together and says, no, that's not factual, that's not true, here's the sourcing.
That's a good point.
You know, so I don't think it's all one thing or another, but it does change, it has changed the life of a writer. It certainly, I think it's made it less lonely, or it's made it feel less lonely.
Meaning you're not just alone in a room typing.
Right, absolutely.
Anymore. You have
that mom's input. In this constant conversation with 850,000 people, which is why it's sometimes hard to get her on the phone. No, I'm just kidding. It's never hard to get her on the phone.
I first picked up one of your books. There's a big book show in New York, Book Expo America, and years ago, I guess it was 2000, I picked up your first book in Galley. I didn't know the history there, and I read that book, and I remember, this is great. I mean, this is just fantastic. And then when we started talking, I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes, there you go. Mm-hmm. What was that like? I mean, there are authors who have gone out into that. Take Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, for example.
Right.
You know, goes under Joe Hill as opposed to using the King name. Did you think of that? Was that calculated at all? Is that a conversation, or you just do it?
I just did it, and it was helped largely by the fact that I had no problems being in front of every camera that was pointed at me. I really, you know, like, I think Joe Hill is a great writer, but he did the exact opposite of what I did, which was, I'm just putting all of myself out there, and I'll just deal with it. People warned me. They said, the head of one of the publishers who was interested in the book said, are you prepared for what they're going to say about you? And I said, absolutely. And the answer, of course, was absolutely not. I was 21 years old. I had dropped out of two schools in a row. If I didn't get a job soon, I was going to be in trouble. I had to sell the book. But no, it was one of those things where if people had been able to lay it all out for me in that moment, I might have stepped back and gone, oh, wait a minute. You know, I don't know if this is a good idea. But I had a wonderful experience. It was a mind-altering experience because the book found an audience. There were other children of celebrity writers who had books come out around that time, and their books didn't find an audience. You know, and they have great lives today, but they're not on exactly the same path that I ended up on. So I feel very blessed and very lucky. But, you know, if I had it to do over again, would I have really fine-tuned the manuscript over several years and really thought through all of it? I don't know. Maybe. You know, what Joe Hill went through in those years were a lot of rejections. He submitted a bunch of manuscripts under that name without anyone knowing who Sonny was, and they were rejected over and over again, and he kept going back to Tabitha, and she apparently kept saying, just keep at it. That's what I told your father. But then on the other side, we have this J.K. Rowling story, right, where she published this novel under a pseudonym, and nobody knew it was her, and it sold, 4,000 copies, and then somebody knows it's her, and it shoots through the roof. Mm-hmm. So it's more a question of what marketing means to books today than it is, I think, about the content of books. You know, it's a strange, publishing is a strange business, and it's changing, and we're all so sick of talking about how it's changing. We would all love to go back to talk about writing. But it is that weird effect of, does it mean something more if it's the child of a writer that you know? And honestly, and I promise I'll stop answering this question with this, you know, we write very differently. This is probably the closest together we've ever been content-wise. This is a supernatural thriller, but I have a very gritty, contemporary, more crime fiction-influenced style than Mom does, and I think that has saved me from a lot of negative press.
How did you both encourage and warn, if that's the right word, at the time? Or do you feel he just picked it up through osmosis, a lot of...
Well, I actually was very sick at the time that he wrote his first novel, and I didn't know about it till it was finished. And I didn't read it till it was in print. And I was very, very impressed. And of course, I'm totally for people fulfilling their dreams, going forward, doing what they want to do. And so I supported him completely from the beginning in what he was doing. You know, I had the sense that he was going to be very successful, which he was. And then when I read the book, I thought it was just terrific. I saw he could do all kinds of things that I can't personally do. Like, he can turn his immediate experience into a novel. I can't do that. It takes me years, generally, to write about a city where I've lived. I didn't get to write about Northern California really in depth till recently, and yet I lived there for 30 years. But Chris could, you know, he could take his high school experience and even before the age of 21, write about that experience. And then he went to college and he wrote the second novel, The Snow Garden, dealing right away with his college experience. I thought that was very impressive. You know, I tried to take a hint from that to let my immediate experience more inform my fiction.
Well, it's interesting, too. We were on stage last night in New York, and we had a similar question, and she was asked about the primary influence on her when she was younger, and it was really radio. There was a radio in the house.
Oh, God love you.
Radio, yeah. Right. It was you, Joe. Radio plays those sort of that form of storytelling, and with me it was TV and movies. And I think writers or novelists will balk at the idea that those other forms influence us as much as they do, but they do.
They do.
I will admit that they influence me.
I'm more influenced by movies and TV than books in what I write. Yeah, definitely.
Still, is that a something that takes time, or is it more immediate of what is sort of happening in the culture at that moment, or?
Well, I just know day in and day out I'm more inspired by great films that I see to just rush right to the keyboard and write. You know, it's they have more of an impact on me than books. I do go through long periods where I read a lot, but then I go through periods where I don't read anything. And I do watch, I think, very high-quality TV shows and movies all the time.
You know? But I got to step in. You read an enormous amount of nonfiction related to research.
I do. I read nonfiction all the time.
You almost
history,
don't have time to read fiction.
All kinds of stuff. I love research.
Yeah.
So give us an example. Like, what would you read for this novel? What would you read?
Well, I read a lot about Christmas customs. I wanted to deal with Christmas in this novel, and I wanted to deal with the fact that Christmas is related to pagan feasts of midwinter that go way, way back in our culture. And, of course, many people have condemned Christianity and said that they overlaid the birth of Christ on these pagan feasts. But I see a continuity. I thought it was sort of a stroke of genius that the church made December 25th the birthday of Christ, which was sort of the celebration of midwinter in northern climes, because it was just a perfect marriage to present the Christ child coming into the world right at the time when people used to go into the forest and build great big fires and implore the light to come back into the world. You know, in the middle of winter, when everything is so dark and so cold, here they were praying for the light to come back, for the spring to return, for the summer to return. And I thought, what a great continuity. And I wanted to explore how these werewolves might celebrate Christmas, being that they're immortal and they go all the way back in European history and history of the world. What do they do? What are their customs at midwinter? And what I did, of course, in the book was I describe how Felix and Reuben and the other man-wolves present an enormous Christmas banquet and fair for the human people of Northern California and then go deep into the forest and celebrate their own werewolf Yule in a very pagan manner, in a very sensuous manner, with a giant bonfire and a lot of bacchanalian carrying on and so forth. You know.
And they're both beautiful.
We're
in their
selling
own way.
Tickets
they're
after
both
that.
Yeah, there you go.
They're both beautiful in their own way. And also, another theme I wanted to explore was ghost stories at Christmas. I mean, ghost stories have always been connected with Christmas in English literature. You know, Christmas Carol by Dickens being probably the most famous one. So I did a lot of research on Christmas customs, ghost stories, the way the Victorians felt about Christmas, why they wrote ghost stories, all of that. I had a lot of fun doing that.
Having written as many different types of novels as you have, is that part of the lure for that, doing that research?
Yeah,
of finding out different things?
I love the research. The research always, it's not just a dry accumulation of information. It sparks all kinds of ideas. You know, I'll look up a type of furniture, for example, a pattern of furniture, and I'll start seeing scenes happening with that furniture and houses furnished like that. And everything gets me going into making stories and plots and characters.
How old were you, Chris, when you realized that your mother had written erotica?
Well,
she doesn't
know anything about
it. What?
That.
I gotta go. I thought we were here to talk about Christian books. Anyway, she said to me, I just want you to know there are some books that I've written that you can't read until you're 21. And what she didn't realize was that most sons don't rush out to read their mother's erotica. And because I tried. We do a sketch on the dinner party show, How Far Can Christopher Get Reading His Mother's Porn? And we've done it twice, and I can't, I'm not very far is the answer. Not very far. But listen, we had two halves to my life in the beginning, which was the Northern California Castro District portion, which was very sort of freewheeling and progressive and then we moved to New Orleans, where she became a big success, but the environment we were living in was a little bit more socially conservative, which is surprising because people see New Orleans as this endless Mardi Gras. But I went from going to a very bohemian hippie school where we called our lesbian teachers by their first names to an Episcopal, let's line up for chapel in the morning, cut your rat tail, take that t-shirt off, put on a polo shirt, you know. And it was great, but it was a stark contrast. And so in the beginning, I probably went to school with other kids whose parents wrote erotica / porn, you know? So it didn't seem that odd at all.
What I always find, I think I've asked you this question before, but you're proud of pretty much everything you've written.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I don't regret any of it. No.
I mean, those are all the, and this is a much overused term, but I mean, that's all the journey that is your
writing
career.
It's all part of the journey, and it was all sincere. I mean, I wrote that erotica with a pure heart. I felt that I had never read an authentic, honest erotica that made me happy, and I wanted to write something that I felt for the people who shared these particular types of fantasies. And I didn't know of anything of real quality that had been done. Well, there was one book, The Story of O, but I felt it was a very dark book. And I wanted to write something lighter and more fun. that didn't involve murder and blood and death, but was sort of like a theme park of S&M. And I did.
You know, we're so also selling tickets to that. After. We won't be there, but we'll sell you tickets.
Chris, I mean, let us not forget, of course, that both of your parents are just wonderful writers. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there has to be something that you take from that. Forget about a genetic component, but just about a work ethic and the importance of literature and reading and research and all of that, I would think, would come into your environment.
Absolutely. And I think it is the discipline that I witnessed, you know, that inspired me the most. You just have to do it. You know, you just have to do it and you'll fix it later. It's not going to be perfect the moment it comes out, but you have to get in there and dance with it at least, well, not at least once a day. I don't make it in there that much. You know, I have to take days off. But that, yes, witnessing that and witnessing the commitment that it took and the immersion that it required of you. But also, I think, growing up in a home where it was seen as a valid pursuit and not a sort of crazy compulsion, which is where the homes that a lot of other people had to grow up in. But I didn't want to be a writer. I wanted to be an actor. My plan when I left high school after being the theater kid and everything was to storm the theater department at my college, and the college theater department proved to be heavily fortified because they did not call me back for a single audition my freshman year, and I was absolutely devastated. But I went to that computer, and I found a connection that nobody could get in the way of. Now, I didn't know if anything would ever come of what I was writing, but that was my world now because the stage had been taken away. So I could go in there, and I was the director and the actor and the stage manager and the production designer all in one. And that's really how it started for me. But yeah, I think they're, you know, incredibly inspiring. But also it's that idea that everything that you have can go into your work. It's that idea that writing, it's not that it requires everything of you, but everything that you've learned, every experience that you've had is potential material. And that was how they lived. It really was. It was how they lived. They were very influenced by On the Road and that idea that Jack Kerouac presented. Just go out and live, you know, just go out and dig it.
The new novel, as you mentioned, is a bit more in a supernatural, more
right.
There's more of a similarity
to
some of your mother's work. What led you down that path, do you think?
Well, I had wanted to write a supernatural novel for years, and I was actively discouraged from doing it. And people said things like, people in publishing said things like, if you can't do what your mother did, don't bother. And I would go to bed for a day. Like, what does that mean? The problem is that I would get stuck in the concept. I would get stuck in this idea of, am I going to try a ghost novel or am I going to try a zombie novel? You know, and what eventually led me to this novel, which is ultimately about a mind control parasite, which was not on the original list, was a group of characters. And it was a decision to write about New Orleans again, which I had said I would never do. My first novel was very harsh. It was very unforgiving of certain aspects of the community in New Orleans. And I wanted to go back, particularly in the wake of Katrina, and tell a kinder, gentler New Orleans story. And because I am a Rice, it turned into a hard supernatural thriller. you know, but I was thinking about this girl, this young woman, Nikki DeLongpre, and she had gone missing. And her boyfriend was a riverboat pilot, and he was destroyed by her disappearance. And her best friend was a reporter, also destroyed. And I couldn't figure out why she had disappeared and what was so mysterious about her until one day it clicked. She's got a supernatural ability. She's got a supernatural ability that she would be tempted to abuse on the people that she loves the most, which is literally controlling them for a limited period of time. So, and then this whole world opened up. But it was the first book I ever asked her to give me notes on, which was exciting, you know, because it's A, it's your mom, and B, it's her, you know. So it doesn't, you know, the notes were not harsh or cruel or unforgiving at all, but they were coming from her. And so, but they were very helpful notes. And the draft that she read of the book is very different from the one that was eventually published, largely thanks to her input.
Please join me in thanking Anne and Christopher Rice for being with us.
Thank you, guys.
On the book show.
Thank you very much.
Anne Rice's new novel is The Wolves of Midwinter. It is published by Knopf. Christopher Rice's latest is The Heavens Rise, published by Gallery Books. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Saratoga Springs, New York, at a Northshire Bookstore event. northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.